Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into this in-depth conversation with Ryan McLeod, the nuclear Bitcoiner, about the importance and safety of nuclear energy and how Ryan is trying to orange pill the nuclear industry by showing how Bitcoin aids the economic case, I'd love to share a few words about our sponsors. First up is new sponsor CrowdHealth. What if you didn't have to pay healthcare premiums anymore? What if you could invest in Bitcoin instead? With CrowdHealth, you can put aside money for health expenses in your own account and even hold a large part of it in Bitcoin. If Bitcoin goes up, you get the upside, not big insurance companies. Pay one low monthly total to fund an account that is yours. Choose your doctors, get great healthcare, and hold up to 75% of the balance in Bitcoin every month. If a large expense comes up, CrowdHealth will help negotiate and crowdfund the bill for you. Stop supporting the broken healthcare system with your hard-earned capital. Go to joincrowdhealth.com and use code MATRIX now and experience freedom from health insurance by utilizing Bitcoin. Right now, you can get your first 6 months for just $99 per month. That's just a fraction of high deductible insurance plans. Go to joincrowdhealth.com and use code MATRIX to sign up. That's joincrowdhealth.com, promo code MATRIX. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply. CipherSafe has a long heritage of creating quality and I think beautiful metal products. Their parent company, Numberall, has been doing it since 1930. With Bitcoin slowly changing people's time preference, they feel it's a great time to focus on making artistic metal items. People can again start to appreciate an item for its beauty and the craftsmanship it took to make it. Their first go is the Bitcoin Rouleau Triangle. It's a fusion of engineering, geometry, and Bitcoin. Its overall shape is the Rouleau Triangle, named after Franz Rouleau. He was an engineer in the 1800s who formalized kinematic theory. Of course, the obvious nod to Bitcoin is front and center. They strive to achieve a beautiful look with the Bitcoin logo, which is textured for an almost diamond-coated look, along with making the Bitcoin logo a raised engraving, which creates a beveled edge to enhance the smaller details. All of this is done in titanium. I hope you find the Bitcoin Rouleau Triangle as beautiful as I do. For more information, go to CipherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with the nuclear Bitcoiner.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Nuclear Bitcoiner, aka Ryan McLeod, is a Bitcoiner working in the reactor research and safety programs at Canadian Nuclear Labs. Ryan McLeod, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
I'm great. It's cool meeting you. And yeah, I'm very excited to chat with you about the idea of nuclear Bitcoin mining.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into it. I've been watching your handle for a while now, and you've been putting out some great content, and I've heard you on a few podcasts. And also, I was down at BitBlock Boom, and there was a panel with Marty Ben. I mean, it was Rabbit Hole Recap, and Marty and Matt O'Dell and Adam Curry was up there, and Ryan Gentry, I think, from Lightning Labs. And the question was around future energy use. And I'll hold the question, but during the panel conversation, Adam brought up SMRs. And it was just like right then and there, I was just connecting a lot of dots just in terms of questions and maybe some like what could be possible. So I'd love to get into a little bit about what you do. Where exactly do you work?
I work at the Canadian Nuclear Laboratories in Canada. It's a facility that's been around since the 40s, supporting the various nuclear research projects that Canada has been engaged with. It's where the CANDU reactors were basically born and manifested into reality. There's a reactor up the road. It's called the Nuclear Power Demonstration Reactor. That was the first power generating reactor that was built in Canada. But many of these reactors that were built at this site have since been retired because they're 60, 70 years old. So they've had a good long life. They've supported a lot of research and development in the space. I specifically work in a laboratory that supports various nuclear safety and research programs, and specifically the CANDU pressure tube surveillance program that monitors the corrosion of the zirconium pressure tubes in CANDU reactors. So we support every CANDU reactor that's built around the globe. The three sites in Ontario, Pickering, Darlington, and the Bruce, and the site out in New Brunswick in Point Lepreau. There's also a CANDU reactor, Argentina, Romania, India, Pakistan, China, and South Korea. I think that sums up all of them. But yeah, we get samples from all of those reactors, and we do the analysis on the pressure tubes and ensure that they are within the operating scope for the pressure tube corrosion parameters. And then once they reach a certain threshold, the tubes are replaced. The laboratory that I inherited 8 years ago has been operating for good 40 years now, monitoring this parameter in the reactors. It's very important because if the pressure tubes crack, then the moderator water can risk leaking into the cooling water, and that creates a big mess. It's nothing catastrophic, but it is an expensive situation that needs to be cleaned up should that happen. So they take great care to ensure that that is not going to be an issue in the future, because the reactors are slated to operate for at least another 40 years, the ones that are operational and that are undergoing refurbishment right now. Yeah.
Right.
Very small piece of an important puzzle.
Right. So what is a reactor exactly, and how big is something like that? And what is a CANDU reactor? Is that a different kind of reactor?
Yeah, a reactor is basically just a large boiler that generates heat that gets converted into steam. That steam turns a turbine, and it harnesses the energy that's released during the process of nuclear fission. And so essentially nuclear fission is when a uranium atom interacts with neutrons, and the neutrons will cause a scattering effect where the uranium atom breaks apart into smaller atoms, and it releases energy and several more neutrons. And then that will create a reaction that cascades throughout the reactor. And in order to sustain that reaction, they ensure that at least one of those neutrons continues on to react with another uranium atom. And they ensure that not too many neutrons continue to react, because then that can create an exponential cascade effect. So that's why they use various different moderators to absorb those neutrons to prevent them from reacting too much. And they basically want to keep the ratio of neutrons generated at one. So they want one neutron to react, and then only one neutron out of the three to continue to react, and the other two will get absorbed. And in the CANDU reactors, the main difference is that they use heavy water relative to the standard boiled water reactors around most of the rest of the world. The CANDU reactors are unique to Canada's reactor fleet. They enable the use of less enriched uranium in order to operate. It can use like 3 to 5% enrichment. The difference being that heavy water uses water that has a higher ratio of deuterium in it. And deuterium having a neutron already in the structure of the water, it doesn't absorb as many neutrons. So it allows for the reactivity of less enriched uranium to proliferate, and then they capture any stray neutrons with various moderating mediums. And then in the boiled water reactors, because they're using standard water, that water doesn't have a neutron, so it will absorb a lot of neutrons from the reaction. So that's why typical boiled water reactors use a higher enrichment of uranium. Hmm. So it's an interesting difference. And then the CANDU reactors, being able to use less enrichment kind of, it lowers the risk of proliferation and various other concerns and safety concerns. Like the CANDU reactors are rated as one of the safest reactor designs that have been built to date.
Right. And how big is a reactor? Like just ball, you know, back of the envelope, back of the napkin kind of visual.
The typical reactor, like the standard size CANDU, it's about 700 megawatts, takes up a few acres of size. So then the main sites, like, each have at least four reactors built kind of in tandem. They'll just be like a long hallway with the reactors and then the turbines that they operate. And then that's a generating station, a nuclear generating station. And then they have several of those in Ontario, the one out in New Brunswick, and then there's a bunch scattered all throughout the world.
And what is 700 megawatts? What does that represent in, I don't know if we're talking about residential homes or some sort of way to kind that of can, think about that.
Yeah, that can manage a few hundred thousand homes. But like the combination of all of the reactors in Ontario add up to, I think, somewhere in the ballpark of about 4 gigawatts. And that maintains like the whole like Greater Toronto and Southern Ontario region, which is at least a few million people.
Right. And how many people work at one of these sites?
At least a few hundred to a few thousand. Probably the bigger ones getting up towards 2,000 or so. And then, depending on the size, like, yeah, they'll be pushing about 1,000 is about the average.
Right. And how long does a site like this take to build?
That depends on the regulations. They used to not take a long time when there was a lot more practice at doing so. Like, there's examples of France having built, like, I think somewhere in the ballpark of 20-something reactors within 15 years. But nowadays, building a nuclear reactor takes a long time to go through all of the regulatory and license processing, especially if it's a new design. I'm not sure if you've heard about the Vogtle reactor in Georgia that's taken nearly 15 years, and it's way over budget, way over time, and there's a lot of complaints about that. It's kind of a sore spot, but I expect once it's completed, then they will be able to transition a lot of that workforce and those expertise to move on to the next project. And it's with each iteration, they get better and faster and more efficient at standing these reactors up. And then, yeah, it's a hell of a project to build a nuclear reactor, because a lot of the costs and everything is front loaded. They have to take into account almost the entire life cycle of a reactor before they can even greenlight these projects. So it's large CapEx, and then that also accrues a lot of interest and just, yeah, lots of time, lots of effort. And then if the regulatory bodies don't maintain like a really strict and stable adherence to the agreed upon conditions about building these reactors, sometimes it's almost like a shifting sands, where if they make a change mid construction, that can result in a significant slowdown on the construction prospects of these reactors. And like, from what I hear, that's happened several times during the Vogtle project, that one of the instances is they had poured concrete in a certain way, and then the regulators came back and told them that that was not correct. So then they had to tear it all up and redo it. And that was like millions of dollars of just poof. So it's complicated projects, but once they're done and operating, like, operations and management is relatively cheap and straightforward, but it's just, it's getting them off the ground that is the hard part.
Right. And what is, I mean, you mentioned life cycle. What's the life cycle of a reactor like?
Yeah, once they're built, they can operate at least a good 40 or so years before any significant refurbishment is required. And just like it, like a classic car, like you can keep it maintained for several more decades beyond what its initial planned lifetime is, because a lot of these parts that are used to build a nuclear reactor are interchangeable and they can be swapped out once they start to degrade beyond a certain point. So what they do is they monitor the life of the reactor, the different core components, and then once certain things reach a threshold, they will just replace them with new parts. And in theory, like some of these reactors could be kept operational for another like 3-4 decades, and about 80 to 90 years is the anticipated lifetime of a reactor if it's very well maintained.
Right. So let's say, you know, it could have a natural death. I don't know if that's 100 years or 150 years or 60, 80, but at some point there's probably some sort of natural death. And then there's maybe sort of the artificial or inorganic death where they just shut it down, like maybe Indian Point in New York. What do you do with a reactor or a site when it reaches its ultimate terminal, production, whether that's, you know, political or anything like natural, you know, just atrophy? What do you do with that site?
They will go through a decommissioning process where they'll first shut it down. They'll remove any fuel that's left over, and they will allow that to burn off any of the short-lived nucleides in the fuel rods. And then once that has all been deemed to be safe, that'll get transferred to various means of storage, such as like that on site. They'll leave them in lead casks in a, basically they're kept in a safe state on site for most of their life. And then the reactor itself will be transferred I'm not fully
sure
aware of like the full decommissioning process, because mm-hmm. it is a complicated process. But yeah, essentially they will disassemble the reactors. They will store any of the harmful radioactive material within like lead containment, and they will do everything they can to bring the site back into a state where it would just be your typical environment.
I mean, it's condos or like a park?
Like, yeah, you probably wouldn't notice any difference between just like a nature reserve is essentially what they will do with these things. So it'll just be left as untouched reserve type of situation.
Does that have to be like sort of factored into the economic calculus?
Oh yeah, like decommissioning is part of the cost considerations before these things even get built. Like, I don't know how much that was maintained like in the older reactors when they were initially built, but definitely when a new reactor gets greenlit, like, yeah, the full building, operations, decommissioning, waste storage, like that full cycle is accounted for before they even go ahead with the project.
Right. I mean, earlier you said something about like Canada's fleet. Who owns Canada's fleet? The government of Canada, or is that a private public partnership, or is that, how does that work?
The reactors in Ontario, two of them are owned by the Ontario's regulatory body, but more just the Ontario Power Generation, which is the main energy provider in Ontario, and they maintain these reactors. They're a pseudo kind of public-private partnership. And then there's the Bruce reactor is owned by a private entity, and then they sell the reactor into the Ontario grid. And then the Point Loprobe reactor is a joint partnership between the New Brunswick government and the operators of the laboratory. So it's, yeah, they're all pretty mixed, public-private to various degrees.
So how safe are these reactors in these sites? I grew up near Indian Point. there was always conversation. I mean, they were always looking to decommission Indian Point, it seemed. It seems like there's a lot of negative connotation around nuclear. So how safe are these sites?
They're varying degrees, but like each time like something happens at any reactor, whether it's a big or small incident, like that learning experience gets applied across the full spectrum of the reactors. So as much of a black eye as Three Mile Island was, that gave an opportunity to learn from that experience and then apply what happened at that incident to the operating procedures of the, all the different reactors, so that an error that happened there could never happen again. And then just with each iteration, like when Fukushima happened, it was learned very quickly that make sure that your backup generators aren't going to get flooded. And as long as you can maintain cooling, then there's very little risk of any meltdown. So there's been a lot of lessons learned, small and large, throughout the years that have been applied to running a nuclear reactor. And it has essentially made the industry probably one of the safest power generation industries that exists now. Like per kilowatt that nuclear power generates, it's ranked pretty close with like wind and solar as far as safety goes. So
hey, you mentioned Three Mile Island. I completely forgot about what happened at Three Mile Island.
I haven't read up on enough on that recently to give you an actual like a really good accounting of that. I would have to look it up and reacquaint myself with it. But from what I understand, it was an operator error that something wasn't monitored properly, and they had some sort of leakage that it got out of control, and then it created a little bit of a larger incident. But yeah, I don't recall the details as well as I should. Like, yeah, I've been a lot more focused on economics these days.
Yeah, and we're going. It's a really wide ranging conversation. What about in terms of, do you remember Fukushima or even Three Mile Island? Like, what were the ramifications? How many people died or got hurt, or and somewhat of the fallout? What was that like?
Well, Fukushima, from what I know, that far more people were killed by the earthquake and tsunami and the evacuation. As far as the records show, there is only one death that can be directly attributed to radiation. So it was a large, very, very grand overreaction to how severe the incident actually was.
Right. And what about Chernobyl?
Yeah. Chernobyl was an interesting one because they had an incident where they were testing some feature about how they could wind the reactor down, and they had disabled several safety features in order to perform this experiment, and something went wrong with how they had the moderator rods set up, and they ended up going super critical, and that resulted in a massive buildup of steam that blew the lid right off of the reactor, and that spread radiation throughout the vicinity that was detected several countries over. But that's like one of the things that you have to remind people about is that was a steam explosion. Like, that was not a nuclear explosion. Like, when a nuclear bomb goes off, that is a completely different scenario than when a reactor overheats its moderator water and then steam creates an excess pressure. But like, a lot of new reactors have means to mitigate a steam buildup with using vacuum chambers that will just flip open a valve and absorb a lot of that excess pressure should that ever happen. So there's another lesson learned and applied across the entire reactor fleet.
Right. And I think at Chernobyl, it was a couple dozen people died, or was it? I'm not sure the exact figures, but it wasn't thousands, I believe.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's somewhere in the 20 to 30 that can be directly attributed to radiation released from that incident.
Right. And the environment there, I think, I've seen some clips of documentaries where I think it's got a really robust nature preserve in the surrounding area. Now, why? So how did they mitigate, or why did they shut down so much of the area, or what did you make of that?
From what I understand, a lot of that is fear-based, because there was concerns about nuclear weapons and in the equivalency of an explosion at a nuclear reactor being on the same scale as a nuclear weapons detonation. But like in reality, it's not even comparable. So the evacuation was a reaction to as if that was a nuclear bomb going off. So they did clear out a massive land amount in order to preserve the population from that incident. But then what I even learned recently was that there were several other reactors that were part of the same facility as Chernobyl that continued operating for another decade or so after that incident. So it's like they kept it going. Like, it wasn't so severe that they couldn't keep those other reactors operating. They only got shut down in the early 2000s.
I wonder what they did with the power generation from there if most of the, you know, community was pushed out. I'm not even sure, but what I'm like, so with Fukushima, it seems like a perfect storm: earthquake, tsunami, you know, just the unforeseen. 3 Mile Island, I don't know much about that, but with Chernobyl, how much do you think that was sort of indicative of like a failing nation state, or was just this a one-off sort of how you described it?
Yeah, well, there was a lot of, if you read a lot of the reports, there was poor management, and nobody wanted to actually admit that there was something going wrong. And there were people higher up within the bureaucratic structure that wanted to see this test go ahead, even though the operators were very uncertain as to whether or not it would be safe to do so. And it was just a matter of poor communication up the entire command chain that was indicative of the Soviet system, where nobody wanted to tell their superiors that they were wrong, and a lot of people were not hearing the right information when they needed to be.
Right. Yeah. I think there's just a lot of FUD around nuclear, a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And it reminds me a little bit of what I've seen around hydrogen and sort of like Zeppelins and that way, that mode of transportation. And I wonder how much oil and gas has sort of propagandized this impression of, I wasn't an avid Simpsons watcher, but even on the Simpsons, it seems like, what did you make? I mean, they make it seem like nuclear is the scariest thing on Earth.
Yeah, their portrayal of nuclear was not the most accurate when you see things like Mr. Burns trying to hide green barrels of goo in the neighborhood park, and the leaks all over the plant, and guys like Homer as their main safety guy. It was, not the best highlighting of the industry. And it puts this image in a lot of people's minds that is completely inaccurate. And it's very difficult to work against. And then on just the anti-nuclear activism side, they got a lot of funding from oil and gas industry, mostly because it's competing for market share. So when you're fighting over precious market, then you will do what you can to ensure that your competitors are at a disadvantage. And it's been a weird few decades following through in the nuclear industry, is there's been a very robust anti-nuclear movement and advocacy group that they've been at it for at least since the 70s, that they are determined to see nuclear not make it. But then I really don't know what the alternative is going to be, because we're not going to be able to cut it with wind and solar at the scale that they are proposing, unless we have oil and gas in the mix. And if they hate carbon, they hate uranium, we're running out of options.
Right. Are there any rational arguments against nuclear?
Well, like The one that they that still kind of holds water is it is very expensive, but that also comes because there's a lot of licensing and regulatory processes to go through to ensure that the safety is not compromised, because the industry is determined to prove to the public that we can do this safely without issue. But that definitely takes a large hit on the finances. And because nuclear reactors are very, very heavy on the upfront capital expenditures, it's difficult to find people with the deep pockets and the long time horizon to invest in the technology like this, when it's a lot cheaper and you get a lot more credits and subsidies if you're going to build just a few fields full of windmills and solar panels.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, we'll get into a little bit of that too. What though is the worst case scenario? And like, what happens if radiation, how does radiation get to the atmosphere, and what happens if it does? How dangerous is that kind of event?
It's in the immediate vicinity. There are some short-lived nucleides that will be relatively harmful, like iodine being one of them, because it is gaseous. But that's like, I'm sure you may have heard about that people that live near a nuclear facility will be issued potassium iodine tablets as a means to mitigate against any iodine exposure. So that basically all it does is it, if you have iodine in your system, it prevents the uptake of radioactive iodine from getting in your system, and it will get flushed out a lot more quickly, because from what I understand, it accumulates in the thyroid. So if you have low iodine, the radioactive stuff has more options to accumulate in your body. But if you have a high iodine level in your body, there's less likelihood for any uptake. There's a few other short-lived nucleides like cesium, but they're heavier and they do drop to the ground a lot quicker. Like, so there is the risk of land contamination, but this is only within probably a few miles of the facility are the most affected. Like, once you start getting beyond that, like the effects are relatively negligible.
Right. So what is your, how does Bitcoin fit into this? What is your Bitcoin rabbit hole story, and how did it intersect with nuclear? I mean, yeah, I know you work at the facility, but.
Yeah. So working at a nuclear facility, I get regular updates on how the industry is going. So I've been seeing over the last few years, the different steps that have been taken in developing small modular reactors. So I've taken about 2 years ago, like I had a moderate interest in this. And then it was in the run up in January 2021 was when I really started to take Bitcoin seriously. Like, prior to that, I had, like everyone else, I had a few touch points. I had some of the content that I used to consume, where I would occasionally stumble across Max Keiser and various other Bitcoin content, like the occasional time when Andreas Antonopoulos was on Rogan's podcast. But yeah, I never really took it seriously until January 2021, because I had a wallet that I had cashed out from an online poker site that was a few hundred dollars back in 2018. And then in 2021, it was now a few thousand dollars. So that was very exciting. Got attracted by the number go up. And then I went right off the deep end, because yeah, Max being one of my first touch points, I went straight into the Orange Pill podcast. And then that led me to Safedean and Breedlove and yeah, the whole rabbit hole. And then it was when I got exposed to guys like Adam O and Steve Barber and what they're doing, building Bitcoin mines to mitigate flare gas. And that really sparked an interest in my mind. And I got excited and I'd be telling my wife about it and going over the top. And then when it was when Elon Musk made his comments about the energy usage in Bitcoin and that he was no longer going to accept Bitcoin for Teslas and had that whole spiel, and then the market tanked. My wife and I were having a conversation and she just threw out the idea of just like, yeah, SMRs, Bitcoin mining. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And she thought nothing of it, as if like, yeah, of course that's something that people have got to be thinking about. And then me being more in tune with the space, I was like, no, these guys are like looking at nuclear and they're like, they're sad. They're seeing all these reactors shutting down and they're like, this is never going to happen. The future of nuclear is falling apart. We might as well focus on what we know with the flare gas and like finding like abandoned hydro or surplus hydro plants. And so I figured, why not jump into this niche and just start promoting this idea? And I started talking to various guys like Greg Foss, and he connected me with another guy, Zach Woods, that was sniffing around the same idea. And then around July, this organization that I'm a part of, the North American Young Generation in Nuclear, was putting forth this idea competition called Innovation for Nuclear, which is coming up with an idea that would help nuclear apply to the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and which, like, on their face, their reasonable goal is reducing poverty, improving health, finding meaningful work, and abundant energy, and various things like that. And it's like SMRs on their own have the potential to apply to a lot of these goals, but they do have one major liability on their economics, is that, like, if you don't have sufficient demand where you're going to build a nuclear reactor, the economic justification just isn't there. So I started to think about how Bitcoin mining fit into that equation, just as a market that they can always sell electricity to, no matter what your local market looks like. You can design it in any profile that we can conceive of because of the modularity of both technologies. Like, you can use old gen reactors, new gen reactors, and combine them in such a way that you're always going to be consuming the maximum power output of a nuclear reactor, regardless of what your local community looks like. Like, if you see some of the charts of like a lot of these communities, especially like off-grid communities, like their demand profile is just up and down like mad between just like the day and night cycles and seasonal cycles. So there's a lot of opportunity to fill in that gap with a market that electricity can be sold to no matter what. And like, there's other technologies that they intend to apply for these reactors, like hydrogen production, like for use as a base gas for more complex chemical production, like methanol and ammonia, that can then be used for even more complex molecules and chemicals, or for fertilizer and various things, desalination plants. They want to use reactor heat for various mining operations and mineral processing operations. So there's a lot of applications for these reactors, but there's always going to be a gap between what the local needs are and what the reactor is capable of. So there's mm-hmm. I foresee there's always going to be room for Bitcoin miners to fit in there. And then, like, I was promoting this idea even before Brandon Quidham put out that pioneer species idea. But then as soon as I read that, I was like, yes, this is what I'm doing. Like, I listened to your interview with Brandon just last night, and I was like, just reiterating that in my head, and it's like, yes, he is thinking everything mm-hmm. that I'm thinking. We are definitely on the same wavelength. And basically I'm trying to take that idea and apply it to Canada's SMR action plan and plant those seeds everywhere, and then let all the more complex industries fill in the space around them and just see where it grows.
There's so much to unpack there. So how much does a regular reactor cost? Like, are we talking about like 300 billion, 400 billion, or 30 billion? Ballpark.
Yeah, for context, the Vogtle reactors, I think, are somewhere in the 20, 25 billion range. The Hinkley Point C is in like the 20, 25 billion range. Like, those are two reactors that are being built like right now as we speak, that are maybe a year or so from completion. Like, those are really the only ones that we have to measure
those
this against.
Those are good numbers. So then what would an SMR cost?
Depends on the size. Like, the smaller ones, they're expecting...
What would be on the smaller side.
Yeah, and there's also the complicating factor of because this is all front-loaded, the first ones are going to be crazy expensive.
Right.
because you've got your licensing, your regulations, getting all your engineering in line, getting your fuel production set up, getting your labor force set up, getting the mass production facility set up. So the first ones are expected to be like for the this first one that's going to be built at the Canadian Nuclear Lab site is going to be a 5 megawatts electric or 15 megawatts thermal. So it's going to be a high temperature gas reactor that puts out 15 megawatts of thermal, and but that thermal energy can be converted. It can be used as thermal energy, or it can be converted into as much as 5 megawatts of electricity, because that's the roughly the conversion ratio when you run steam through the turbine. It's about 33%. It's just a standard like Rankine cycle. That one is expected to be about $200 million to build the first one. But then they're anticipating like by the time they've built like a dozen or to 20 of these things, they will have that price point down to like the $20, $30 million range, which will be okay. significantly less. But that's just each iteration is going to improve. It's like any technology, like the more iterations, the better the workforce gets at building them efficiently. The supply chains get a lot more lined up and in tuned. It's.
I like these numbers. I thought you were going to say like $2-3 billion a piece. So who, okay. What I found really interesting there too. So what group were you a part of and who ran the contest?
Well, the group is called North American Young Generation in Nuclear. It's just like a little advocacy group within the nuclear industry. Like there's a chapter for it at various different areas. Like we have our own little Chalk River chapter, and there's a chapter in Southern Ontario, and there's chapters all throughout Canada. There's
nuclear scientists and technologists and chemical technologists and people working in various sectors of the nuclear industry.
Yeah, whether they're at actual like nuclear facilities or universities doing nuclear research. Basically, the criteria to be part of it is that you have to be doing something related to nuclear and be under 40 years old, which I'm 36, so I'm getting towards the top end of that, but I still fit in that criteria.
So it's actual, I was going to ask if it's only young people, because maybe it was, you know, the young is just part. So very interesting. So this is really cool. And then who ran the contest? Sort of maybe the head global branch, or who ran the contest? I'm kind of, well, who was the audience of these papers?
Yeah, it was like the American Nuclear Society was the one that was kind of overseeing at least the North American aspect of it. But then, yeah, now that we won the North American phase of this competition, so now my team gets to go to speak at an international conference to promote this idea. It was scheduled to be in Sochi, Russia on the May long weekend, but that was kiboshed by the events in Ukraine. And it's since been rescheduled to the end of November in Kuriyama, Japan. So we are very much looking forward to that. There's going to be a good opportunity to evangelize about Bitcoin to a lot of interesting people in the nuclear space. And
well, this paper is great. This paper is really fascinating. And what we touched about a little bit earlier in the show, but it's addressing a lot of the UN sustainability goals. And I thought this was an interesting point you guys rose, that there's a significant economic and social inequality between communities that have access to affordable energy and those that don't. I think that's kind of obvious, but I never really thought about that before. And, you know, we've talked a lot about, so what are some of the other high energy intensive applications that these SMRs can be, you know, applied to wherever they're distributed? Besides just, you know, I kind of get, you know, the Bitcoin mining, we touched on a little bit, that's going to help make the grid more sustainable because you can turn it on and off. But what are some of the other applications that these SMRs can be turned to?
Some of the applications, they want to build SMRs that will be applied to the oil sands out in Alberta. Like Alberta and Saskatchewan are interested in building small modular reactors, which is interesting because they're not nuclear power jurisdictions. Typically that's been Ontario and New Brunswick, and formerly Quebec. They used to have two reactors that were shut down in 2008-2009 or so, about 12-13 years ago. that what's interesting about them is, Alberta wants to apply SMRs to a lot of their oil and gas infrastructure so that they can decarbonize a lot of their industrial processes, because not only can they use the electricity, but they can also use the high quality steam for a lot of their oil and gas processing. And then in Saskatchewan, that is where the bulk of the uranium mining exists in northern Saskatchewan. So they want to, instead of using natural gas and for their processed electricity and heat, they want to convert that to using SMRs for their electricity and heat, which will streamline the entire supply chain of nuclear much more efficiently. And then, on top of that, they want to deploy these reactors to a lot of like remote potential sites for mineral mining. And then they'll be able to use the capabilities of the reactor to build processing facilities a lot closer to the actual mining sites. And then they can distribute that to the products from those processes for wherever they need to go. It gives a lot more economic opportunity for communities that have been very underserved for generations.
Right. So, I really want to get into that too, especially around the Brandon Quidam, the pioneer species, and sort of the, indigenous either communities or just stranded communities in a lot of ways, but or even oasis communities and future oasis communities. But how rare are these inputs like uranium that we need for nuclear power? Are they scarce?
No, God, we have so much uranium. Like, if the will was there, we could have so much uranium we wouldn't even know what to do with it all. Like, there's a lot of untapped uranium resources throughout Canada. There's throughout South America, Africa, Australia's got a ton of uranium, like Russia and several of the other countries in like around the Kazakhstan area. Like, there's a lot of uranium. From, I forget where I heard this, but someone recently said that if Canada had the will, we could double the global uranium output just from Canada alone. And then on top of that, a lot of this uranium that gets used in the typical reactors that exist doesn't fully get consumed. So there is a lot of energy left over in these fuel rods if they are to be reprocessed and put into new types of reactors that are able to use that as their fuel and get as much as like 80 to 90% more of that active energy out of these fuel rods. And then that has the added benefit of decaying the nuclides in the uranium fuel further down the decay chain so that there will be less long-lived material that needs to be stored as waste if it's able to be consumed by a reactor. So there's a few reactor designs that are being proposed right now that will consume waste as its fuel source. So that's very, I'm very much looking forward to seeing how that plays out.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more about the paper that you guys wrote and some of the goals here. So what do you see this doing for Indigenous communities if we deployed SMRs? What would be around like things even around like food and health?
Oh, it'll dramatically improve their standards of living. Like, typically now, a lot of these communities are running off of diesel generators that are decades old, and they just maintain their stability by shipping in this diesel at very narrow time frames during the year because of the conditions in northern Canada. It's not easy to get that trucked in or shipped in by airplane in some cases. Like, some of the communities that are near the oceans can get it barged in, which is a little bit cheaper. But overall, in order to get the costs down to being equivalent to their southern counterparts, there's massive subsidies in the orders of like 60, 70 kilowatts per, or 60 cents per kilowatt hour in order to drive down the actual cost of fueling these communities. Like, but pre-subsidies, some of them are paying as much as a dollar per kilowatt hour. And that was before we entered this crazy period where diesel has gotten wildly expensive. So I expect it is significantly worse now. So only spurring us to get this show on the road and get this development going a lot quicker, because yeah, these communities, it's very expensive for their electricity, and then that leads into lower standards of living, because if they can just barely hanging on by what their electricity costs are, that means that their food's more expensive, that means that their healthcare is more expensive, they're isolated, so a lot of these places don't have the greatest banking infrastructure, it's just they don't have the greatest water infrastructure. Like, it's been several political cycles of the each time a new leader comes in, part of their big promises is that they're going to bring clean water to a lot of these communities that have been struggling with that for generations. And sometimes it's successful, and sometimes it just seems like it's just throwing money at a problem that doesn't really get it solved. Like, we need to create a situation where they have the capability to solve their own problems rather than just trying to solve the problems for them, and bringing them robust energy supplies that will sustain these communities and make it a lot cheaper for them to maintain a lot of this infrastructure will be a massive boon to levelize their quality of living with basically everyone else that lives on a active large grid. Whereas, yeah, like these small communities, it's expensive to maintain that infrastructure.
Yeah, I could see it bringing a lot of relief to these small communities, especially as we bring the economy to scale down in price. I mean, if we could deploy these SMRs for $10, $20 million and help them desalinate water and build greenhouses and use that sort of energy to help build better food and hospitals and run those hospitals. What about, though, we were talking about Brandon Quidham and Pioneer Species, and so that's how it could help, like, communities that already exist. Do you think this technology is going to help build communities that don't exist right now? New oasis communities that will flourish because maybe they can deploy energy in different ways or create energy where there isn't any energy now?
Yeah, there is no reason why that couldn't happen. Like, we have a pretty good idea of the types of like mineral resources that exist in various parts of Northern Canada. There's been surveys going on for decades, but it's never really been economical to invest in the development of them. Like, there's pretty like robust diamond mining in Northern Canada, but like because you get a significant return on your investment if you can get diamonds, the economics are there, but other industries hasn't quite been there. But now if we can deploy these reactors and have that customer in place before we even set up a mine or and a processing facility, and then so that will boost the economics of the reactor and justify the deployment, and then from there now you've got the seed to develop an ecosystem that will support the whatever like mine and processing facility that you want to build to extract whatever resources you've got there. And then that's going to support, you're going to need to support your workforce, you're going to need to build your transmission infrastructure that's going to kind of sprawl out away from the reactor to wherever the community and the mines and various needs are. And then it's going to plant some really interesting seeds and build communities. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if we get to the point where if Bitcoin does what a lot of people are anticipating it does, like I hear interesting calls, like it could be in the millions by the 30s, and that will be around the time where this technology starts to mature, that a lot of Bitcoiners are going to have the capital to invest in these projects and make them happen. And I wouldn't be surprised if Bitcoin miners start trying to buy their own small modular reactors and find a plot of land and just drop the reactor in a Bitcoin mine as a seed and just see what happens and build communities around them. It's like, it's got real kind of like Atlas Shrugged type of vibes, where we can just go and build our own communities. This is the type of people with the right, like, low time preference mindset to really develop some interesting projects, and I would love to see it flourish.
Yeah. So that brings me back to something I want to talk about at the beginning of the show, which was the debate Matt O'Dell and Marty Bent were having around whether in the future, when these SMRs are in Bitcoin or hands and quite economic, would something like the hash rate, would 50% of the energy in the world be used for Bitcoin mining, or would it be closer to like 1%?
That is a really interesting question, because it's like, it could be a wild variance. Like, it really depends on how much energy we deploy. It depends on how...
Right. What is the denominator? How much energy are we producing, and then how much are we using for Bitcoin? But if that denominator gets really big...
Yeah, Bitcoin still stays a fraction.
Right. Which is an interesting part of the debate.
Like, yeah, like we could be... Like, one of the things I think I replied to one of Marty's tweets recently was just like, yeah, Bitcoin might still be 1% of the global energy consumption, but that 1%, for all we know, might be more than the global energy consumption we have right now. Like, we could be generating more electricity than humanity can even conceive of right now if we really let this stuff take off. Like, I like the idea that Tomer puts forward in his generational wealth video, that where like, yeah, we could do some really crazy stuff and build the future we wish to see, and start heading up the Kardashev scale, where we just start harnessing stupid amounts of electricity to and feed whatever we're not using at the time to Bitcoin, and then that gives us the like a delayed scale to like sustainably build infrastructure to match the new energy infrastructure. And then as like the pioneer species idea works, that the Bitcoin mining can peel off as more sophisticated industries come in and are willing to pay more for that electricity. But ultimately, it's going to drive the cost of electricity down to almost nothing. It's just going to be a highly competitive market finding the cheapest electricity that's available. And right now, surplus electricity is worth nothing when it's generated. Like, if you don't have a market to sell your electricity to, it's not worth anything. And if you now have a market that sets your floor, like even if you use an S9, your floor is about 4 cents kilowatt hour, even in the bear market right now, which is a dramatic improvement over curtailing as much as like 25 terawatts in a year. Like, that's what Ontario alone just curtailed or sold at negative prices in 2019. Like, at 4 cents kilowatt hour, that's $1 billion on the table. So that could be a revolutionary scale change in the dynamics of electricity generation, because that is not a problem that is isolated just to Ontario. Like, that is everywhere, because of the way that electricity grids work, because you need to have enough electricity operating at any given time to match what your potential peak load is. And you're not always going to be at that peak load. It'll just be like a freakish spike, like what happened in Texas a few times, like last winter and last summer, when they needed to ramp up their heating or their air conditioning. And it applies like in many different jurisdictions in northern communities. Yeah, they're going to have a lot of heating needs that spike up at various times in the winter. And then on the flip side, like if you're in equatorial conditions, like somewhere like El Salvador, you're going to have spikes in your air conditioning needs. So as long as you've got something to fill that gap of the electricity that you need to have available to make it economical, instead of just curtailing it when you don't need it, that changes everything. Like, I'm trying to get this to sink in with the right people in the industry, but it's one of those things. It's just, it sounds too good to be true when you're first being exposed to it. It does take a lot of processing about how this thing works, and it doesn't sink in the same for everybody. Like you and I have been down the rabbit hole deep enough that like, once you see it, you see it. Like, I remember watching when Safedean was talking with Jordan Peterson, and just that whole, the energy arbitrage idea sunk into Peterson's head. You could just see his wheel spin, and he's just like, hold, like this changes everything. Like, electricity that wasn't worth anything before is now worth something, which changes the whole industry. Doesn't matter what type of electricity you're generating. Like, Bitcoin doesn't discriminate against where you're getting your electrons. It's going to be an interesting future, especially like some of the projects that I'm seeing happen in Africa. Like, I heard, what was it? Obi was talking about this company called Gridless that's now using Bitcoin mining to justify building energy infrastructure in different communities. And then there was this one community, and my father recently told me about, it's near Sudbury, Ontario. It's a small hunting community called Sultan, and they run a few diesel generators and a hydro plant that adds up to about 700 kilowatts, but they're completely isolated from the main grid. So at that small of a grid, even like a few kilowatt fluctuation can be disruptive to the frequency of the grid. So what they do is they have a theater that's just full of space heaters that just click on and off to maintain that stability. And then you tell that to like a room full of Bitcoin miners, and they're just like, where is this community? We can fix that like now. Like that sounds like such a ridiculous idea. And the Bitcoin miners still act as a space heater, which is even cooler. Like we can, like there's so much potential in this technology pair up. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's wild.
Yeah. Especially in terms of, you guys noted in your paper, I think around Bitcoin mining in the North, there might be advantages there. Cause you'd save on sort of temperature moderation and control. And I'm curious what you think of, and what your peers might think of what's going on right now. I mean, we got rising energy costs. We have nuclear power plants being decommissioned. Maybe some coming online at some point. But, and you guys, it seemed like in Canada, it's part of your export business, nuclear technology. So where do you guys think nuclear, I think nuclear is at what, 10% of, you know, contributing to the world's power supply right now or something like that? Maybe that's a North American number or something, but do you think we're going to have more nuclear power production in the future? Do you think people are starting to think about this? Is the tide changing? Are you guys getting frustrated?
There was definitely frustration for the last few years, but it seems something really flipped around like late summer, fall 2021, where it was starting to become more and more apparent that something is very, very wrong in Europe right now and the policies that they've been pursuing with their shutting down their nuclear reactors and heavily depending on wind and solar, and then also depending on an adversarial nation for a lot of their hydrocarbons, which has definitely manifested in a very precarious situation for Europe this winter. And I do not like that this is how nuclear is finally getting more recognition that it deserves, but it's kind of almost like the fourth turning idea, just like some weak men created hard times, and now we're gonna have to take advantage of learning from those hard times to come out the other side. Like the 20s may be tough, but if we can properly learn the lessons from a lot of poor governance and taking energy infrastructure advice from a high school dropout, then we might come out into the 30s doing a lot better, but it's going to be a precarious next few years for some of those European countries that are paying electricity bills that are comparable to a mortgage, which holy crap. Like, I don't like seeing people in a situation where they've got to choose between heating their homes, paying for electricity or food and shelter. Like, that's especially where that they never had to until recently. And you can blame it on whatever external factors you want, but a lot of it came down to just bad policy in the electricity infrastructure and energy industry.
Yeah, I hear you. I want to cite a little bit from the paper you guys wrote. The University of Wyoming has started a Fundamentals of Bitcoin Mining course. They teach fundamentals of proof-of-work data mining and learn from hands-on experience from donated ASIC hardware from industry professionals that wish to encourage more formal educational opportunities in proof-of-work mining. They soon intend to implement a formal curriculum that can be replicated in any educational institution. In regards to nuclear, two announcements have been made regarding the explicit intent to pair Bitcoin mining with nuclear energy generation in North America. Talen Energy in Pennsylvania intends to build a large technology campus that includes a Bitcoin mining data center that will use as much as 300 megawatts. Compass Mining has partnered with Oklo in California to build as much as a 250 megawatt of capacity
in conjunction with the new SMR design that they are intending to bring to market later in the 20s. So do we know of anyone mining Bitcoin with nuclear at the moment?
I just learned recently on the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, they had on, I forget what his name is, Matt something. He's one of the CEOs or something of that nature of CleanSpark. They have a heavy foothold in Georgia that uses a significant amount of nuclear power on their grid. And they were discussing how they take advantage of being able to claim that they use mostly clean energy by being on a heavy nuclear intensive grid. And they are also very excited to see the new reactors in Georgia come online, expected sometime next year, because that's going to add a lot more capacity. And I foresee that attracting a lot more Bitcoin miners into that jurisdiction once that finally takes off, because that's a lot of electricity. And if they may be able to shut down some of their coal and natural gas in order to, that's kind of why nuclear gets built, is to reduce the need for coal and natural gas for electricity production in various heat applications. But there's going to be a huge opening for Bitcoin miners to move into that space. And I'm very much looking forward to see how that plays out, because this is also going to provide a lot more use cases and demonstrations that this is a viable way to go. That then, as the industry starts seeing these cases proliferate, as the SMR technology starts to come into play and starts to mature, we will already have many instances to draw upon of how this already works. And aside from the Talon Energy at the Susquehanna reactor in Pennsylvania, which I've been speaking with Alex Brammer on, and he's very excited to see that come into fruition, which they're very close to getting that set up. And then there's another project that I'm aware of that's still in its early stages in Ohio to collaborate with their power generation utilities to put some Bitcoin mining behind the meter at their nuclear reactor facilities. If you read up on those reactors, like just about every reactor in play right now has some degree of economic liability that is just a gaping hole that can just be plugged by giving them a customer to sell that electricity to, like no matter when, no matter where. Because electricity isn't always stranded geographically like what the stranded gas guys do. Like sometimes electricity is stranded temporally, like just it's not the right time. And if you have that customer there, 24/7 availability. And then on top of that, it gives a nuclear reactor, which typically runs at base load and doesn't like to be scaled up and down. Like some of the reactors do have the capability to be scaled up and down, but they can only do it for a limited time window before it starts causing disruptions to their operation. And then there's also the economics of, like, you want to run your reactor at like 95% capacity factor, which is like really pretty much the only time you want your reactor not operating is when it's shut down for maintenance. When it's not, when it's operating, you want it operating full tilt 100% of the time to justify the economics. So having the Bitcoin miners there will basically give the reactors a spinning reserve on the demand side that they can operate in the same way that a natural gas plant would operate as a spinning reserve on the generation side. So you can overgenerate and then play the Bitcoin miners kind of as a dimmer switch to maintain your stability regardless of what your local demand is doing. That is going to plug a lot of holes and basically flip one of the biggest economic liabilities that nuclear generation stations suffer from into a revenue source. I hope they start figuring it out soon, because they are going to have a massive windfall the sooner that they figure this out.
Yeah. I want an SMR. I feel like there's like, you get a generator, and the next step is an SMR. How big is an SMR compared to the reactor? Is this like a small house?
Depends on the size. Like the one that they're planning to build, the little 5 megawatt electric one that they're going to build at CNL, it's going to take up like a quarter of our parking lot is what they're expecting it to be. Like it'll be like the size of like a track and field, like
Right.
basically a standard field. Like the bigger ones up when you get up to the 300 megawatt range, which is the high end of what's considered a small modular reactor, they kind of break them into three different categories, like the mini ones, the medium ones, and then the kind of larger small reactors. The typical reactors are in the range of like 700, 800 megawatts. So that's those are your standard ones. But 300 megawatt reactor, they're expecting them to be, I don't know, probably like roughly the size of like a college campus. It's not
Okay.
gonna like fairly big, but like not outrageously big like the few acres that a typical reactor requires.
Yeah, we just need upstream. When upstream could fit in a box, let me know. I'll get one for personal use. I
We're
once
getting
got to go
there.
to, I hope so. I once got to go to Indian Point in the year 2000. I was working for Consolidated Edison of New York, and we did a field trip to Indian Point. And while we were there, the alarm happened to go off. And some of the guy next to me said, "Should we run?" I said, "Well, it's probably too late if it's real." I think that this is the next nuclear arms race at hand, not just in terms of civilization and being able to provide a prosperous life for your civilians. That provides not the right word, but energy production is directly correlated to quality of life. So if a country can produce energy, then their citizens will have a high quality of life. And I think that's going to be a race. But I think Bitcoin mining is going to end up being a nuclear arms race of sorts for nation states once they get in the game. I think they'll be the last to come into the game. I'm not trying to say they're anytime soon they're coming in, but when they do, I think they're going to point their nuclear energy at Bitcoin to some extent.
Yeah, I definitely don't disagree with that, especially if nations that have an adversarial stance towards each other, if one starts doing it, the only way to reduce the amount of reward from mining Bitcoin is to mine more yourself. So it's going to be interesting, like, because I've seen the announcements that Gazprom in Russia has started eyeing up this industry to take advantage of. Like Russia has a lot of standard stranded energy assets, lots of flared gas, lots of isolated hydro. So they are in a pretty
I
good
have to
position to
think,
take advantage of this industry.
I have to think some nation state is taking advantage of this in an undeclared manner.
I've heard rumors that like Iran has substantial Bitcoin mining. But like that's speculative as to how
That's
much
yeah.
they have going on there. There's various other countries, like there's all kinds throughout like Argentina and Venezuela where they have like dirt cheap energy, but they have trouble bringing it to market because they essentially destroyed their currencies. Like you got countries, I heard Laos is intending to mine Bitcoin. Like they've got something like 8 megawatts of surplus hydro that they generate that they can take advantage of. There's I think I heard something about like Ecuador's got some hydro assets that they want to start mining with. Like we've all heard the stories about El Salvador wanting to start mining with
Volcano.
volcanoes. I've heard of different countries throughout Africa. Some of them overlap with the countries that had visited Bukele a few months back about checking out his Bitcoin project. Some of them are interested in developing nuclear power assets, particularly Ghana and Uganda are looking at it. Like this is going to be everywhere. And then you start thinking about I don't know how much you follow Jason Lowry and the thesis that he's talking about, the mutually assured preservation idea that he's putting out there, where it's just if you want to be able to process your transactions, if there are adversaries out there that are willing to censor transactions coming from your jurisdictions, all you have to do is have your own mining infrastructure. And it may take a little bit longer, but there's nothing in the world that can stop you if you are putting hash rate in the game. It's going to be a hell of an arms race once these countries start figuring out how this works. Like it's interesting hearing about all the big brains talking about it and how this could play out in the long term, but it's Like I foresee a massive gold rush and some sort of arms race. And then one idea that I like that I've been toying with, that if this game theory plays out, is if we're start directing like a lot of nuclear power assets towards Bitcoin mining, then not only will that reduce the incentive to divert nuclear fuel into potentially being enriched into nuclear weapons, but it could also start pulling things in the opposite direction. Like if there is a stronger incentive to generate more hash rate to outcompete the rest of the network, then I could foresee a situation where nuclear weapons start being reprocessed into more fuel to generate more power, to generate more hash rate.
Nonviolent warfare.
Like it could get very, very competitive at like that scale. Like I've been told by some of the people in the industry that that is definitely a fanciful idea, but mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure we were told in the 70s that the Byzantine generals problem would never get solved. And Satoshi seemed to prove them wrong on that one. And then I don't know if you've listened to Tomer's latest piece with the Satoshi Nakamoto's treasure, and where he was kind of talking about that idea of just like it makes you rethink like what is possible, like what have we been told that is impossible that we can now totally rethink now that something like Bitcoin exists, because it forces you to re-examine everything that we thought we believed. And there's a vast array of potential out there now, and a completely new frontier for us to explore.
What I love about it is not only does it gives us a new way to look at different things and question it, but it provides an anchor of truth that's irrefutable. So it works, it does what it says it does, and not a lot of things in the world do that right now. Whether it's, you know, like, meaning nuclear is great, but a lot of people say it's not great, you know, and you can go on and on. Whereas, you know, the Bitcoin code is true. I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. I want to read the conclusion to your paper, because I think it's important to touch on this.
Was my wife. Yeah, she put that bit together.
Awesome. All right. So let me. So it is clear that solutions need to be found that are realistic and attainable now. Climate change, inequalities, poverty, hunger, and sustainable futures are issues that cannot be ignored. These problems are too big for any one solution to accomplish alone. With strong partnerships between small modular reactors and digital asset mining Bitcoin, these new innovative technologies, local engagement, and support from individuals and communities can have an impact that will resound through generations. Creating sustainable cities and communities founded in cooperation, teamwork, and trust will last. These places will not have poverty, hunger, or inequalities. These places will have food growth fresh in their own communities, light, power, and warmth that is both affordable and, most importantly, clean and environmentally friendly. By implementing this change, new possibilities that have not been thought of will be conceived, and ideas far more exciting will be inspired by it. With Bitcoin and SMRs, we can start building today for a better tomorrow.
I know. I like it. It gets me going. Every time I read it, like, I've found myself just, for each time I do like a podcast, I'll go through and I'll reread this stuff. And every time I'm just like we really did put something pretty good together to promote this. Like, is we had tight limits on the length that we could do. So we were shaving it down and making sure that we had everything that was important. And yeah, elaborating on the cooperation and building sustainable communities was a huge part of this. Because it also gives like these communities a big opportunity, because they have the issue of either not having the opportunity to develop their intellectual capacity, or they will lose it because they get the brain drain of anybody that does have potential leaves the community and goes somewhere else where they can make a life for themselves. But now, if we have this new frontier that we can start exploring, they have a stronger incentive to stay in their own communities and help develop and build them and help them like grow in the direction that feels like culturally relevant to them. And they can maintain the significance of their cultural heritage, because a lot of these communities, like, they've been there for generations, like much longer than even the Europeans have been on the continent. So like they have strong ties to their environment, and it would be great to see them develop in such a way that they can participate on an equal footing to the rest of the world. And by having that affordable energy, by having a tool like Bitcoin that allows them to engage in commerce at a global scale, it's going to severely reduce the inequalities that they experience between their, like, the southern counterparts. And it's going to give us a big opportunity to start developing northern Canada. And yeah, I would really, really like to see this idea take off. Like, the intention's already there with the SMR action plan to start upgrading these communities to nuclear, but it's still going to take several decades to start making a dent in a lot of this stuff. So my hope is that by applying Bitcoin mining to it, we can dramatically reduce the ROI to I times, and then that will reduce the amount of capital that's required, because you won't be paying out as much interest on these. And yeah, we can get a lot of these communities, like, over that kind of valley of death hump, where it's like, before Bitcoin mining, there's something missing in the economics of developing these deployments. But now that we have that customer that exists anywhere at any time, that totally changes the dynamics. So I'm trying to influence the right people that can make these decisions, people that are playing around with hybrid energy systems models, and I just want them to add one variable into your equations. Like, you've got some really fancy math equations. Just what happens if we take your surplus energy that's basically worth zero, or you need to store it in batteries or thermal storage, and now there's a price for it. And how does that affect the economics? How does that affect your greenhouse gas emissions? But then, even more important than that, like, it's the second order effects of, like, how does that affect the communities that these are going to be deployed in? And, like, what does that mean for the people that have never experienced having affordable standards of living, that have just been barely hanging on by a thread for generations? And there's too many issues in these communities to even get into, between just like substance abuse and suicide. Mm-hmm. It is tragic hearing a lot about these things. And like, here in Canada, in a few days, we have the Truth and Reconciliation Day, where we remember a lot of the sordid past that we've had in our relationship with Indigenous communities, and hoping to rectify it. And yeah, by remembering the past, we can help to build a better future for everyone, and come together in a way that's not really like imposing our ideas upon these communities, but just building partnerships and collaborating to help everybody build a brighter future.
Yeah, I hear everything you're saying. What I love about Bitcoin in so many ways is as an accountant, it changes my unit of account. And so I can make better calculations, economic calculations. But the way you were getting into it there, we're talking about base load of energy, and how Bitcoin could change the calculations around energy and help communities thrive. I do think that this is going to take long-term thinking, like pioneers, to bring this technology, these solutions, to these communities right now. But I think down the road, this is going to be gradually, then suddenly, and they're all going to have them. And the ones that have them first are going to thrive and prosper way more than the ones that come to it last. So I hope this way of thinking, and because I think nuclear just seems so apparent and so obvious, but I don't think it's an easy sell right now. And for most people, I think they have a lot of FUD. So I hope this way of thinking really starts to, you know, come to the surface. And I think one of the things that I really would love to see, and what you're getting at, is that not only can we help these communities, you know, survive and thrive, but we're going to unearth a lot of human capital value by helping these communities thrive, because then the people in these communities can just produce so much more and trade and commerce and contribute to society on levels that they're maybe not able to right now. Sort of like the way ghettos and cities hamper, you know, human creativity and value. So, you know, I'm really excited for this conversation and what's happening. I leave it to you for, you know, any parting words or, you know, final thoughts, and to let people know where they could find you and your work.
Yeah, all we need is to demonstrate the capabilities. And so once these reactors have proven what they claim to be capable of, then yeah, we will finally we'll have that gradually then suddenly movement. And even though not everybody is attracted to this idea, those that do will have a very outsized advantage over everyone else, and they will become an example to aspire to for everyone else. And like, yeah, I would like to see this advantage be given to first to a lot of the communities that have been historically underserved, to give them the opportunity to see what they're capable of. Like, we have no idea where we're going to find like the next Einstein or Elon Musk type of like brain that could unlock the next great idea that brings humanity forward another major step. Like, but yeah, if we don't give people the opportunity to achieve what they want to, we're not going to see it. Like, because it's also going to provide a lot of educational opportunities as well. Because Bitcoin miners bring good internet connectivity wherever they go, because they need it for their game. And so that will also benefit these local communities. And then it's just another avenue that they can piggyback on. But yeah, I'm very excited for the future. I'm very excited for this idea. I'm going to keep promoting it until it finally sinks in. And like, I don't know, maybe someday I'll be able to let it go, but there is so much potential here. And as long as I'm one of the few people in the space that's doing it, I'm going to keep at it. Yeah, people can find me on Twitter, it's Nuclear Bitcoiner, and keep an eye out for me. If anybody that's going to be at adopting Bitcoin, I'm going to be talking there about selling the idea of nuclear power to that conference, and because there's a lot of interest in Central American and South American countries, African countries, to get into nuclear power. Canada's a world leader in this space, and once we finally build this technology, we're going to start exporting it, is the intention. And it's going to be a race, because we are not the only ones that are building this technology. So it's going to be interesting, and I'm very excited to see how it plays out, because competition is what pushes innovation. And it's going to be a bright future.
Bright orange future. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ryan. This has been so dope.
Yeah. Great talking to you. Thanks for having me.
This episode with the Nuclear Bitcoiner, a.k.a. Ryan McLeod, was powered by CipherSafe and CrowdHealth. Please support our amazing sponsors. Drop a dope review on your podcast app. And if you want to support the show directly, I have tips open on Twitter. As always, my DMs are open for feedback, or if you want to let me know about a great idea for a show. Maybe you have a great story to share. Hit me up. TikTok, Next Block, Stack Stats, Stay Humble, and thank you for listening. This is Cedric. Peace.